All right, we begin the reading of today's Boston Globe. On the Talking Information Center for today, it's Friday, the 12th of June, 2026. You're listening to the Talking Information Center, and we say hello to Pamela and Joan.
Good morning, this is Pamela.
And good morning, this is Joan.
Ultimate Trump. Cage fights at the White House. When he's encountered particularly difficult times during his political career, President Trump has turned to a reliable refuge, ultimate fighting. Just months after the January 6th riots at the Capitol, when Trump's political future was its most uncertain, he popped up at an Ultimate Fighting Championship fight in Las Vegas. 2 years later, days removed from pleading not guilty to 34 felony counts of falsifying business records in New York, Trump was again cage-side at a UFC event in Miami, greeted by raucous chants of USA. And again, in the year after, shortly after he was found guilty on all 34 counts, Trump was cheered by a UFC crowd in New Jersey. For a president with an eye for spectacle, who fancies himself a fighter above all else, the marriage is natural. Much of the UFC's overwhelmingly young male audience also count themselves as part of his MAGA base. When general public opinion of Trump is low, he knows the UFC crowd, its fighters, and the company's top brass all have his back. In short, it's Trump's safe space. And now, at a time when his approval ratings are near a record low, he brought it to the White House's backyard. On Thursday, I took in a surreal sight on the White House South Lawn, a 92-foot overlapping steel arch structure dubbed the Claw. As I passed the West Wing, it peeked out from behind a magnolia tree and a bronze statue of George Washington. Hundreds of members of the Washington Press Corps were given a tour of the space where the UFC fights will take place on Sunday, Trump's 80th birthday, ostensibly in celebration of the country's 250th anniversary. Approaching the Claw, I wondered whether this is what gladiators must have experienced walking into the ancient Roman Colosseum. And similar to those bouts of old, the only people who will be able to get as close to the fighting cage as I did will be elites. This is an invite-only event. No tickets will be sold to the public. Attendees must either be summoned by the president himself, purchase a $1.5 million VIP sponsorship package, be a member of the military, or get a nod from UFC president Dana White, as Tom Brady, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, and Adam Sandler reportedly have, though none have officially accepted the invitation, according to Vanity Fair. UFC fans, or curious Washingtonians, without those lofty connections will have to settle for watching the action on jumbotrons from the Ellipse, a green expanse just south of the White House residential grounds. The Claw itself is situated on the South Lawn, famously where the President's Marine One helicopter takes off and lands. On Thursday morning, the 5,000-seat structure, complete with four jumbo screens, dominated the landscape. One of the only patches of South Lawn grass not enveloped by the Claw is the President's putting green. At the epicenter of it all is the cage, where blood will be spilled. The octagon, made up of eight black chain-link fence walls, is surprisingly small in person. Just 30 feet in diameter, the cage offers about 750 square feet of fighting space. Although the mat in the octagon was covered by a tarp to protect it from possible rain, its red, white, and blue color scheme is visible if you looked hard enough. What was not hard to notice, however, were the corporate sponsor logos that adorn the cage's padding. RAM, Morgan & Morgan, Bud Light, Crypto.com, all with a once-in-a-lifetime ad space in front of the People's House. On Thursday, the press corps was given near free rein of the Claw structure. Only the cage itself was off-limits. That freedom gave me the opportunity to take in an unencumbered view of Trump's White House renovations. To the northwest, the paved-over Rose Garden, gold oval office lettering, and a bronze Founding Father statues gleamed in the morning sun. In just a few days' time, the main event fighters will walk out to their chosen music from the Oval to the Octagon. To the north, the Executive Mansion perfectly framed the Octagon, with a Secret Service agent watching us intently from the roof. To the northeast, construction on Trump's ballroom was ongoing to the humdrum tune of heavy machinery. To the east, the Treasury Building was draped in America 250 regalia. To the south, the lawn's fountain is flanked by temporary UFC-branded structures, similar to the kinds of vinyl tents used for outdoor weddings. Looming even farther away was the fan area on the Ellipse and the Washington Monument. To the west, the Eisenhower Executive Building stands ready for its conversion into UFC fighter locker rooms. All this comes at a hefty cost, of course. White has said the UFC is set to lose $30 million on the event, but will not receive any taxpayer money. A lawsuit attempting to stop the event recently revealed it has cost at least $60 million. Even so, for a marketing opportunity such as this, it's a small price to pay. The fights will surely be the pinnacle of a mutually beneficial relationship between Trump and White and the UFC that began in 2001. Back then, the UFC was far from mainstream. The late Republican Senator John McCain famously derided mixed martial arts as human cockfighting in 1996 and led efforts to ban the sport across the country. As such, White struggled to find a venue that would host the UFC for his first fight and charge the promotion. In stepped Trump, who offered up the casino he owned in Atlantic City that was known as the Taj Mahal. The rest is history. Trump and White became fast friends, whose relationship has even survived Trump backing a rival MMA promotion in the late 2000s. The president has become a fixture at UFC events, attending the first of his four fights as the sitting president in 2019. White, in turn, has presented Trump at two Republican national conventions. On the 2024 campaign train, Trump showed up at six UFC events in person. White was credited with encouraging Trump to appear on podcasts that are popular with young men, not least that of Joe Rogan, a longtime UFC commentator. The seeds of the White House UFC card were planted shortly after Trump won the 2024 election. White said Trump suggested it as the two took in a fight at Madison Square Garden. Still, White insists there are no political undertones to his latest link-up with Trump. If you love America, you're going to love this event, White said during a recent appearance on ESPN. It has nothing to do with politics. We just happen to be on the White House lawn, and the President of the United States will be there. Joni?
Murder conviction and girl's death overturned. A spokesperson for the Attorney General's office said the state is disappointed by the court's order and intends to pursue a retrial on the murder charge. The New Hampshire Supreme Court overturned Adam Montgomery's murder conviction on Thursday in the fatal beating of his 5-year-old daughter, Harmony Montgomery, citing a procedural flaw in how the case was tried. Prosecutors vowed to retry the case, insisting they remain confident in the evidence that led to the 2024 conviction. Montgomery, now 36, was convicted of second-degree murder for recklessly causing his daughter Harmony's death and of second-degree assault for an early incident of physical abuse. Prosecutors said the fatal incident occurred while the family was living in a car after they had been evicted from their home. But the High Court ruled that keeping those two charges together in a single case jeopardized his right to a fair trial. The Supreme Court reversed Montgomery's conviction on the murder charge, but affirmed his convictions for assault, falsifying physical evidence, witness tampering, and abusing his daughter's corpse. Those convictions, combined with an earlier unrelated firearms case, mean Montgomery will remain behind bars, according to Jesse J. O'Neill, a lawyer who previously worked as a homicide prosecutor with the New Hampshire Attorney General's office, but was not involved with the Montgomery case. While it is very significant that the murder charge got overturned, there are a number of other convictions that have not been disturbed, and that, at least for the time being, continue to keep Adam in prison for decades, he said. O'Neill said this ruling is about procedural safeguards, not court questions, concerning Montgomery's conduct. He said prosecutors presented a strong argument to support the murder charge. A spokesperson for the Attorney General's office, Michael S. Garrity, said the state is disappointed by the court's order, but insisted it will push for a second trial. We remain confident in the facts of this case, the evidence presented, and the exceptional work of our prosecutors, investigators, and law enforcement partners, he said. We will continue our effort to seek justice for Harmony Montgomery and all those who knew and loved her. Excluding his sentence on the overturned murder conviction, Montgomery still faces a total of 43 and a half years in prison on the other charges for which he was convicted, Garrity said. If prosecutors retry the murder charge separately and secure another conviction, O'Neill said, it's possible that the trial court would simply leave Montgomery's original murder sentence intact. The public defender representing Montgomery on appeal, Pamela E. Phelan, said the ruling addresses important aspects of fairness in criminal proceedings. Justice is only served when we provide a person accused of a crime a fair and just trial, Phelan said. A trial that is not conducted with those principles in mind does not do justice to persons accused of a crime or people who are victims of crimes. Julian Jefferson, an attorney who previously worked for the Public Defender's Office in New Hampshire and now teaches criminal law at the University of New Hampshire, said keeping criminal charges separate is especially important when the evidence presented at trial to support one charge isn't nearly as strong as that to support another, as happened in Montgomery's trial. While multiple witnesses testified that Montgomery, having assaulted his daughter months before her death, the only direct evidence that he had delivered the fatal blow came from the testimony of his estranged wife, Kayla Montgomery, who served time in prison for initially lying to authorities investigating Harmony's disappearance. The defense attorneys questioned Kayla Montgomery's credibility and argued she may actually have been the one who caused the girl's death. Jefferson likened this case to that of Alex Murdaugh in South Carolina, where the state Supreme Court recently overturned a double murder conviction. As with that case, he said, the justices here aren't declaring Montgomery blameless. Rather, just as in South Carolina, the court is requiring to protect us all that any conviction for murder be proven beyond a reasonable doubt to an unbiased jury, he said. Aside from the criminal proceedings, Montgomery also was found civilly liable in May for his daughter's death and ordered to pay nearly $15.5 million in damages to her estate as part of a wrongful death lawsuit filed by the girl's mother, Crystal Sorey, who reached a separate $2.25 million settlement with the state of New Hampshire. Sorey said in a statement shared with the Globe by her lawyer that Thursday's ruling is shocking and heartbreaking. The ruling comes just a few days after what would have been Harmony's 12th birthday. After believing that justice had been achieved, this means we'll have to continue with this chapter for many years, Sorey said. Our focus remains on seeking justice for Harmony. The circumstances of the girl's death in 2019 represent a shocking case of abuse that spurred calls for reform to child protection services in both New Hampshire and Massachusetts. Sorey lost custody of her daughter in 2018 as she struggled with substance abuse. She pushed for authorities to keep the child with the foster family while she sought to regain custody. But a Massachusetts judge instead awarded custody to the child's father, despite his violent criminal history. The ruling from the Supreme Court notes that evidence at trial showed Montgomery had discussed a plan to dismember and dispose of his daughter's body. He bought lime, a grinder, and a blade, thawed her remains in an apartment bathtub, then refroze her body after several hours. In March 2020, Montgomery left in the middle of the night with his daughter's body in a bag, returned without it, and told his wife he got rid of her. Harmony's absence went largely unnoticed by authorities for 2 years until Sorey grew frantic in late 2021 and came to Manchester to find her missing child. Adam Montgomery never divulged the location of his daughter's remains, which still have not been located. At the sentencing hearing in 2024, prosecutors offered to reduce their recommendation by 10 years if Montgomery would tell them where he hid her body. He stayed silent. Manchester Police Chief Peter Maher said on Thursday that his team has full confidence in the Attorney General's office. Nothing about today's ruling changes the tragic loss of a young child whose life mattered deeply, or how much this community cared about Harmony, he said. Her memory continues to resonate throughout Manchester, and our focus remains on seeking justice for her. Pam?
War in Ukraine has now gone on longer than World War I. Trench warfare, war of drones, rule the front. The war in Ukraine has often been compared to World War I for its brutal infantry assaults and heavy casualties. Yet the idea that it could, by any measure, surpass a conflict so long and bloody that French soldiers hoped it would be the last, once seemed unthinkable. That is just what happened on Thursday. The war in Ukraine, which reached 1,569 days, or more than 4 years and 3 months, has now outlasted World War I. When President Vladimir Putin of Russia sent his troops into Ukraine in February 2022, he believed the country would fall within days. After Ukraine pushed the Russians back and the conflict settled into a war of attrition, even many of those fighting could not imagine it would last this long. I thought maybe 2 or 3 years, and then politicians would find some kind of consensus, said a Ukrainian soldier who, for security reasons, gave only his call sign, France, a nod to his time in the French Foreign Legion. But the war has raged on, and with peace talks stalled, it shows no sign of ending soon. Polls suggest that about half of Ukrainians believe it will not end before the next year, which would push it closer to another threshold, the duration of World War II, which lasted 6 years. And there are many Ukrainians who would argue that the current war really began in 2014 when Russian troops seized Crimea. Historians caution that drawing parallels with the two world wars has limits. The global scale of those conflicts, involving many theaters and armies, makes comparison about casualties and firepower difficult. Ukraine did not exist as a country during World War I. Still, the war in Ukraine, like World War I, is likely to rank among the most consequential conflicts in modern European history, said Yaroslav Hertsak, a Ukrainian historian. Both wars transformed Europe's geopolitics by reshaping military alliances and driving a defense buildup not seen in decades. Military analysts also note that both conflicts reshaped the nature of warfare through the introduction of new technologies, planes and tanks a century ago, drones across the air, sea, and land today. In both cases, the advances made war only more brutal for humans. In many respects, this war in Ukraine is the one that most closely resembled World War I, said Michel Goya, a former French colonel and military historian. The comparison begins with the opening phase of both wars. In 1914, the Germans launched a rapid offensive towards Paris in the hope of securing a swift victory. Russian forces had the same objective when they raced towards Kyiv, Ukraine's capital, in 2022. In both cases, the attackers came close to their target but were ultimately driven back. Eventually, both wars settled in mostly static fighting along a largely frozen front. When soldiers on the Ukrainian battlefield hunkered down in trenches and bunkers in late 2022, historians described it as a return to World War I-style trench warfare. Scenes from the trenches of eastern Ukraine closely echoed those in northern France a century earlier. Ukrainian and Russian troops were often separated by just a few hundred yards, sometimes close enough to see one another. Assaults began with artillery barrages to batten down the appointment, followed by the storming of enemy trenches by infantry squads. In general, when the front freezes, you're back to World War I, Goya said. In both wars, he added, it was the intensity of firepower, mainly artillery, that forced armies to turn to trenches. You bury yourself to protect yourself, he said. The calculus later changed in Ukraine with the introduction of a new class of weapon, drones. Networks of open trenches were rendered unsafe as drones monitored the battlefield around the clock and struck with greater precision than artillery shells. As drones have come to dominate the battlefield, World War I-style opposing trench networks, separated by a narrow buffer zone, have given way to miles-wide contested combat area scattered with dugouts. In this kill zone, any movement is quickly targeted by drones. Large-scale troop assaults of the kind seen a century ago had become all but impossible under the constant gaze of drones. Such assaults have been replaced with attacks by just one or two soldiers. Tanks, first introduced in 1916, were still a feared weapon in the first years of the war in Ukraine. They are rarely used now because their size makes them easy targets for drones, though some tanks have been retrofitted with protective metal cages that turn them into Mad Max-style vehicles. So grinding is the fighting in Ukraine that Russian advances have been at times been slower than those in some of World War I's most deadlocked battles. Russia's offensive on Pokrovsk, an eastern Ukrainian city it recently fully captured, progressed at an average pace of about 75 yards per day, slower than in the Battle of Body bloody Battle of the Somme during World War I. The question now is whether either side can break the deadlock. In World War I, the Allies prevailed by combining economic pressure on Germany through a tight naval blockade with military pressure through relentless offensives. Ukraine's strategy to end the war carries some echoes of that approach. Drone strikes on Russia's oil assets, the backbone of its economy, are designed to curb Moscow's ability to finance its war effort. Kyiv lacks the manpower to replicate the offenses of World War I, but it has flooded the battlefield with small attack drones in the hope of inflicting unsustainable losses on the Russian army. This is World War I, but with drones, Hertzschak, the historian, said.
AI-generated news enough for some on the South Shore. The digital site South Shore News faced a significant test when founder Justin Evans put up a paywall in April. Would readers pay for artificial intelligence-generated articles that recap town government and school committee meetings? As it turns out, the answer is yes. So far, Evans has 350 paid subscribers, many of whom are deeply invested in town politics and want to learn more about how neighboring towns from Weymouth down to Plymouth are tackling common issues. While the audience is still small, it's a sign that despite skepticism about the technology, there could be a larger audience for AI-generated local news, albeit with a limited focus. The site has become a significant side hustle for Evans. He expects to generate $25,000 in revenue this year against less than $2,000 in costs, not counting his own time running the site. Enough for him to think about expansion. It felt like a real make-or-break moment for me. I decided this is either going to be something or it's not, Evans, 36, said. The reception has been enough for me to keep going. Communities on the South Shore have been starved for news about local happenings as legacy outlets have cut back on all but the biggest stories. South Shore News can't replace everything that's been lost. Readers won't find interviews with students at a high school science fair or a visit to a nursing home to note a 100th birthday. Instead, nearly all of the coverage originates from AI transcriptions of public meetings broadcast on websites. Evans acknowledged that it has made some mistakes a well-sourced human could possibly avoid. It struggles to understand locals' accents at times, for instance. It is concerning that it is replacing the best reporters to some extent, said William Quigley, the police chief in Cohasset, who purchased a South Shore News Group subscription he shares with fellow officers and government offices that include the town manager. But unfortunately, we're not riding horses to calls anymore. Things change and you have to adapt, I suppose, Quigley added. Evans, who has served on the Whitman Select Board since 2019, started South Shore News in 2024 after being frustrated with the lack of reporting on town government in the region. The site covers 19 towns south of Boston. Subscription starts at $8 a month or $80 for a yearly plan, and over 3,000 additional free subscribers to the site get previews of each article. South Shore News uses Substack to publish its articles, but transcribing public meetings that are posted on YouTube. Evans will use Google's AI tool Gemini to transcribe videos. He uses an open AI-based tool for any public access videos that are posted elsewhere. For the written articles, Evans said he found Claude to be the best large language model for first draft of stories. After that's done, he'll use another model to edit the article. He also has set up an AI-generated summary of what's happening in the region to be sent to his inbox each morning to get a sense of what's happening across the South Shore. Some articles will be town-specific, while others will synthesize common issues across multiple towns. Evans will often start with a summary of the most important takeaways. Within the article, Evans will hold key names or figures, add subheadings, and include linked timestamps that allow readers to view the specific part of the meeting that is being referenced. I check YouTube every day. I check the community sites at least a couple of times a week for the non-YouTube videos, Evans said. I've published 1,900 stories on South Shore News in 2.5 years. Recent stories include coverage of the Plymouth County Commission seeking to rent a property for additional revenue, Hingham residents lodging complaints to the select board about an MBTA bus route in their neighborhood, and a roundup of local high school commencement speeches. While many readers said they were initially wary of whether the AI-generated outlet could reliably document the latest school budget crises or votes to override property taxes, they're largely willing to accept the mistakes in place of watching marathon local meetings on YouTube. Several said that early on there were frequent errors, but that the stories have recently been more accurate. Some lamented the erosion of local newspapers that previously would have spearheaded town coverage and said South Shore News was the best way to stay updated. "I'm a baby boomer, and newspapers were always the way to go," said Mary Waldron, a paid subscriber who lives in Brockton but serves as executive director of Old Colony Planning Council, which serves many South Shore towns. "But that weekly notice wasn't keeping us informed necessarily instantaneously." Dan Kennedy, a Northeastern University journalism professor who researches local news, said that in terms of reach alone, there's no other outlet on the South Shore that is comparable. But he worries the embrace of an almost entirely AI-generated news site could have adverse effects on other local news outlets that are based on traditional reportage, such as the South Shore Times, as well as the potential to start new ones. "One of the dangers that we see in the local news crisis is that you can have ventures like this South Shore News spring up based on IE and providing something that leads people to say that it's better than nothing," Kennedy said. "But at the same time, they could block the rise of human news outlets or harm the ones that are already there." He added that in addition to reporting the news, local news outlets also help build community and connect people. "It's a spark for civic engagement," Kennedy said. "That's something AI can't do anything at all." Even some subscribers said that they felt the site wasn't quite the same work as a news outlet, but that it remains a helpful resource. "I don't think AI is journalism," said Candice Niffin, a South Shore News subscriber who is retired and lives in Halifax. "It's like listening to a summary recording to me, and that's better than nothing." Evans is also upfront about the limitations of the service. He said he's had people reach out asking if they could publish opinion pieces or have him dig into an investigative story, but he's turned them down. "I'm not trying to look for scoops here," he said. "I'm trying to provide a public service of, this stuff is going on in your town. Here's a place where you can find out about it." While the profits aren't enough for Evans to leave his full-time job working for the State Department of Public Utilities, he has his sights set on hiring a part-time editor if he can increase revenue to about $30,000 to $35,000. On an annual basis. Before adding staff, he is also looking at expanding regions or even starting a print paper in order to get access to legal notices, which many towns still require to be published in print. "I think there's an opportunity there to roll out a print sheet, which may seem kind of backwards for an AI-driven news service," Evans said.
Meteorologists talk of a Godzilla El Nino cycle. Experts fear costs of droughts, fires, U.S. effects vary. El Nino, nature's chaotic climate agent, has formed in a warmed-up Pacific Ocean and is expected to grow to historic strength, meteorologists announced Thursday. Experts said the El Nino, a natural warming cycle, should further heat a globe already warming from fossil fuel pollution and will likely turbocharge extreme weather across the planet. Meteorologists forecast it will rival, or exceed, a record El Nino that began in 1997 and help trigger billions of dollars in damage from heat waves, floods, droughts, tornadoes, and wildfires. The U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration officially confirmed the existence of the El Nino, which is a warming of the Pacific near the equator that affects weather patterns across the globe. NOAA's announcement said there's a 63% chance that the El Nino will get so intense this late fall and early winter that it would rank among the largest El Nino events in historical record going back to 1950. The warm, deep waters of an El Nino affect weather patterns by bringing a lot of extra heat to the surface, fueling a lot of extreme events for a lot of places around the world, said Clark University climate scientist Abby Fraser. The weather patterns' effects vary by region. El Nino often dampens, but doesn't eliminate, Atlantic hurricane season activity, but increases it in the Pacific. So while the U.S. East and Gulf Coast may get a break, Hawaii and other islands are more in danger, Fraser said. Northeastern Africa is likely going to get weather whiplash from intense drought to dangerously heavy rains, said Columbia University climate scientist and El Nino expert Mohamed Azhar Ehsan. In the U.S., El Ninos can cause more intense storms with heavier rainfall in the south, but they also tend to generally benefit the U.S. agricultural industry, said John Gottschlag, operational branch chief at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center. Michael Ferrari, meteorologist and head of research at the investment research firm Mobi, said conditions for grain and seed, especially soybeans, look favorable in 18 major growing states, but are more mixed when it comes to dairy and cattle. Overall, temperatures raised by the weather pattern can dampen American economic growth, said Stanford climate economist Marshall Burke. Several climate scientists forecast that 2027 will be the hottest year on record because of lagging effects of this El Nino, which is expected to peak in the fall or winter. We have pretty clear evidence that the U.S. economy grows more slowly when temps are above normal, Burke said. The weather extremes caused by El Nino also depend on when it develops. Usually, El Ninos form in the summer, peak in the late fall or early winter, and peter out next spring, scientists said. However, Ehsan's team forecasts that this El Nino will peak a month or two earlier based on strong early signs from recent weeks. Scientists predict stronger El Ninos as the world warms from the burning of coal, oil, and gas, Frazier and others said. But she said it's too early to say that this El Nino is part of that. Even before it officially formed, this El Nino has gotten nicknames ranging from Super to Godzilla. Instead of scared, we can ask people to be prepared, Columbia's Ehsan said.
People wait, watch for Trump's name to leave Kennedy Center. Bike guy aims to prove it's still there. Counter AI. Every day for the past week and a half, Andrew Martin has pulled up his cycling shorts, hopped on his 8-year-old Trek Domain SL6, and biked to the banks of the Potomac River to photograph himself in front of the Kennedy Center. He is proving that the name Donald J. Trump is still there and waiting for it to come down, perhaps on Friday. Martin's daily missives have turned him into a hero for a certain subset of social media followers, people who are as eager as he is to see President Trump's name ripped from the building, and who wants their feeds populated with reports from other humans, not machines. "Thank you, bike guy," wrote one follower. "Yours is the only word I'll take for this." Martin, 51, is a Washingtonian, a government librarian, and a lifelong fan of the Kennedy Center. As a young child, he visited the center with his parents. As an adult, he cheered while his wife, Julie, sang in the concert hall with the Choral Arts Society of Washington. As a parent, he beamed watching his youngest daughter, Genevieve, serve as a mini maestro for a Christmas Eve performance of Hark the Herald Angels Sing. He was devastated when Trump's name was added to the building in December, and elated in late May when a federal judge ordered its removal. But it was an AI video that brought Martin back to the arts institution. The weekend after the ruling, which also halted plans to close the building for 2 years of renovations, a striking video of the center circulated online. It showed crowds cheering as workers in heavy parkas tore the Trump name from the building, letters crashing dramatically to the ground. Though the video was posted alongside real images of cherry pickers outside the Kennedy Center, Martin immediately suspected it was fake. So during his lunch break, he took a 20-minute bike ride and snapped a picture to prove Trump's name was yet to come down. He posted the photo to his social media accounts. The next day, he biked back to do it again. And in a little more than a week, Martin, known online as the Drybrarian, saw his following on Threads climb from the 3 digits to more than 30,000. "It turns out there's a real hunger for the truth," he says. "There's a lot of people out there who really want to know what is actually going on. But there's an equal amount of people feeding the AI slop machine." After his first post went viral, followers began asking him to bring along a physical newspaper each day to prove the date and to prove he was really biking there every day. "It makes it feel like a hostage video," he laughs, "like a proof of life video." To Martin, Trump's takeover of the Kennedy Center feels like its own hostage crisis. "But we can't negotiate with Trump because he wants to shoot the hostage, he says, speculating on the neglect he believes could happen to the institution. If he takes his name down and it dies, he'll say, "See, I tried to save it, but you wouldn't let me." And we'll all have are the ragged holes in the marble facade. Since Trump's takeover, the center has become a frequent site of protest, drawing drag performers, dancers, and demonstrators respond to the president's statements and the institution's changes. With his daily 10-mile rides, Martin has joined a small community of people keeping vigil at the center. The most constant presence, and his newest friend, is Laura Bly, a Vienna, Virginia woman who spent 10 years working backstage with the National Symphony Orchestra. Now, as the symphony nears its centennial anniversary, Bly worries about its future. The Kennedy Center will not approve their budget, so they can't formalize and announce the next season, she says, from her station in front of the plaza's flagpoles, while holding a cardboard sign that reads, "Time to fix the facade." Interest in Martin's posts ramped up as the clock has wound down on the judge's order to remove Trump's name from the building. The deadline is Friday. "We are complying with the court's order while evaluating all legal options to preserve this revitalization and recognize President Trump's leadership," the center's spokesperson, Romo Davari, said last week in a statement.
And from the Metro section, jury finds Alvin Campbell guilty on 21 of 22 counts in rape assault trial. A jury convicted Alvin Campbell Jr. of rape and sexual assault charges following a harrowing weeks-long trial of the man accused of repeatedly posing as a rideshare driver and preying on drunk and unconscious women. The verdict on Campbell, the 45-year-old elder brother of State Attorney General Andrea Campbell, came just before the close of court business on Thursday, following 30 hours of deliberation stretched over a week. Ultimately, the Suffolk County jury of 6 men and 6 women convicted him of 3 counts of aggravated rape, each carrying a sentence of up to life, as well as 4 counts of rape and others, including indecent assault and battery, attempted rape, and photographing an unsuspected naked person. The jury deadlocked on 1 additional rape count, writing in a note to Judge Mary Ames, "It's been at least 8 hours of discussion on that charge alone." In light of that, Ames declared a mistrial on that count. After the verdict was read to a crowded but silent courtroom, Suffolk District Attorney Kevin Hayden told reporters that the result, following thorough investigative effort by Boston police and a complex 3-week-long prosecution by 2 of his office's unit chiefs, sends a strong message to survivors of sexual assault. "We will always stand by them and with them," Hayden said outside the courtroom. The jury determined that Alvin Campbell was what our prosecutors presented in court, which is a man who cunningly, deceivingly, and calculatedly preyed upon women in their most vulnerable moments. Campbell, a tall, broad man dressed in a brown suit, did not have much of an apparent reaction as the verdict was read. After Ames had been taken into custody by the Department of Correction, he gave a sharp nod of his head, but said nothing. The case hinged on what lawyers say are complex questions of consent and incapacitation. Prosecutors allege that Campbell posed as a rideshare driver and lured drunk women into his car, where he sexually assaulted them while they were passed out and therefore unable to consent. Campbell's lawyers argued that sex was consensual and the women were active participants. In order to prove this kind of rape case, the prosecution had to convince jurors that Campbell knew or should have known the women were too drunk to be able to consent. To that end, Assistant District Attorneys Aaron Murphy and Lynn Feigenbaum, the chiefs of the Sexual Assault and Major Felonies units, respectively, relied heavily on sexually explicit videos Campbell himself filmed on some of the encounters. Ames ruled they were so graphic they could only be viewed by jurors, though audio could be heard throughout the courtroom. In her closing remarks to jurors, Feigenbaum argued that for years Campbell drove around Boston in his black Chevrolet Suburban while posing as a rideshare driver anywhere where the bars would be letting out and drunk women would be on the street. She said he targeted women who were staggering or stumbling and lured them into his car with the offer of a quick ride home. But instead, she said he sexually assaulted them when they became motionless or silent. Campbell knew that these women were too drunk to consent to anything, too incapacitated to have the ability to say no, to fight back, or to consent, too incapacitated to know what was happening to them, Feigenbaum said. For years, Feigenbaum said, Campbell was the only one who knew the extent of what he had done, because the women couldn't remember. Some of Campbell's victims only learned of the assault when Boston police notified them in May 2020 that they appeared in graphic videos found on Campbell's phone. During the trial, jurors heard from testimony from six women who offered similar accounts about climbing into Campbell's SUV while drunk, then waking up with fuzzy memories about what happened. Two of the women said they passed out and woke up at Campbell's apartment in Cumberland, Rhode Island. One of those women reported she'd been raped in December 2019, prompting Boston police to launch the investigation that ultimately led to sexual assault charges against Campbell involving nine women. Jurors heard allegations related to seven of the alleged victims. The woman whose allegations triggered the probe testified that she was drunk and tired when she left a holiday work party at the Harp restaurant near TD Garden, Boston, just before midnight on December 6, 2019, and climbed in the black SUV driven by a man who matched the description of the driver on her Uber app. She said she had no memory of what happened afterward until she woke up the next morning, naked and suffering from vaginal pain, in bed next to a naked man. She said she had no idea who he was or where she was. She later learned the man had taken her to Cumberland, Rhode Island, and was not her Uber driver. She testified the man dropped her off at a nearby CVS, where she called an Uber to drive her back home to Boston. She sought a medical examination that day, then reported the alleged rape to Boston police. Police arrested Campbell the following month after identifying him through surveillance and DNA and obtained a search warrant for information stored on his phone around the time of the alleged assault. After discovering videos of Campbell allegedly sexually assaulting the woman in the back seat of his SUV while she was unconscious, police expanded their search of his cell phone and extracted additional videos of other alleged victims, according to trial testimony. Boston police identified the women in the videos and alerted them. 30-plus hours of deliberation was unusually long for any trial. As the 12 jurors hashed over the details, they sent several notes with questions to the judge. In one on Tuesday afternoon, they asked several technical queries on the elements of kidnapping charges. Ultimately, they convicted on both kidnapping counts. After that, 2 days passed without another note. Then, around 3:30 p.m. on Thursday, one came. The juror told the judge they had reached consensus on 21 of the 22 counts, which they do. Ames used the discretion afforded to judges to decide to take the partial verdict. The mistrial on the rape count means that the charge remains unresolved. Prosecutors can decide to pursue it and push toward a second trial on that count alone, or they could drop it or seek a plea deal. After the verdict, Murphy said that's yet to be determined. Campbell is due back in court June 29th for sentencing.
From the opinion pages, Plattner won over Maine Democrats. Can he win in November? At the end of the day, it will be Maine voters, not the national media, Washington pundits, or Democrats in other states, who decide whether Plattner has the character and value to be a U.S. senator. Maine Democrats have spoken, and their decision should come as no surprise. Despite the steady drip of damaging revelations about Graham Plattner's past, the combat veteran turned oyster farmer easily won Tuesday's Democratic primary for U.S. Senate, gaining more than 70% of the vote. He will now face five-term Republican Senator Susan Collins in the November general election. On Morning Joe, the morning after primary day, co-host Mika Brzezinski asked Plattner whether there would be more revelations to come. Revelations, that is, beyond the inflammatory comments he made on Reddit years ago, beyond the reports that he was bullying and borderline violent with women he was dating, and more recently, beyond the explicit text message he has acknowledged sending to women who were not his wife. In his response, he didn't exactly say no. "I just want to make this clear," Plattner told Brzezinski. "There's nothing out there that is actually concerning. People will make everything seem very concerning, because that's what people do in politics. This is what everyone wants to make the campaign about, so that we do not talk about the struggles of working Mainers." If that sounds like a dodge, it certainly was. So you can assume that more embarrassing reports, perhaps with pictures, will trickle out in the weeks to come. But Plattner's response also contained a grain of truth, namely that the national debate over who the real Graham Plattner might be will rage on, all but drowning out substantive debate over whether Collins deserves a sixth term. It is more than reasonable to question whether Plattner has the character and values one should expect in a U.S. senator. But at the end of the day, it is a question that must be answered by Maine voters, not the national media, Washington pundits, or Democrats in other states. And therein lies the challenge for Plattner. Can he convince the majority of Mainers that he has indeed come to grips with the war-induced PTSD, he says, underlies his rage, rashness, and other toxic behavior? If he can, there is strong evidence that many residents of his state are open to his populist and progressive message. He has endorsed universal health care, spoken passionately about the plight of working people, vowed to get the U.S. out of Middle East wars, and called for raising taxes on the wealthy and breaking up tech monopolies. While Republicans say his message is far too left-wing for middle-of-the-road Maine, polls have shown him ahead of Collins, though the margin has tightened in recent weeks. His message, amplified by his abundant vigor and charm on the stump, also drove Governor Janet Mills, the Democratic establishment's favorite candidate, to suspend her campaign in April, after trailing Plattner by a wide margin in polls. Mills' name was still on the ballot Tuesday, and if Democrats were truly fed up with Plattner's antics, they could have still pulled the lever for her. But only 19% of them did, despite strong turnout, higher than in 2020, when revulsion with President Donald Trump's first term drove large numbers of Democrats to the polls. Though the Democratic presidential candidate, Joe Biden, took Maine that year, Collins was still reelected by 9 points. But it seems that many Maine voters are prepared to give Plattner the benefit of the doubt, warts and all. He needs to seal the deal by doing the hard work of answering voters' questions honestly. He should be well-suited for the task. His campaign soared from obscurity to a commanding lead based in large part on grassroots organizing and his willingness to go everywhere and talk to anyone. By his own count, he has held more than 80 town hall meetings in the past 8 months. Collins, among the last of New England's once proud tradition of moderate Republicans, cannot be counted out. She is a supporter of abortion rights, has worked to provide solid constituent services, and has tried to stake out more reasonable approaches to immigration than the xenophobic dogma that governs the Republican Party under Trump. But outsider politicians can be a powerful draw these days, and Collins has spent a lifetime in government. More to the point, she has proven unable or unwilling to moderate her party's radical shift to the right under Trump. Neither has she done much to counter Trump's blatant corruption or slow his chaotic dissemination of important federal agencies. It is perhaps asking too much to expect one senator to be able to do all these things, but it is precisely because Collins and her fellow Republican senators have been so easily shoved aside by the president that so many Mainers seem willing to support a charismatic oyster man with no political experience despite his checkered past. It is possible that if new, more damaging revelations about Plattner appear in the coming weeks, he will be forced to quit the race. And even if he does stay in, it is far from clear that he can defeat the wily and seasoned Collins. But many Mainers seem ready to restore Congress as a co-equal branch to the presidency. The door for Plattner may no longer be wide open, but is not yet closed. It is up to him to walk through it with integrity, maturity, and honesty, like a good senator would.
Fighting words, the revolutionary kind. 5 shows look at American independence from a mostly verbal perspective. Fireworks, the pyrotechnic kind, are what's most commonly associated with the 4th of July, loud, colorful celebration. A more fitting association would be with words, the fighting kind, loud, polemical celebration. 5 new exhibits key to the imminent 250th anniversary of American independence remind us the revolution really was a war of words. The title of one of the shows says just that. War of Words, A Citizen's Eye View of the Revolution, runs through August 7th at Harvard's Houghton Library. The library's John Overholt curated. The Declaration of Independence was, in effect, a set of fighting words, 1,320 of them. 3 of the 5 shows feature multiple copies of the Declaration. The printing of all but one copy was either soon after July 4, 1776, or from the 19th century. The one that isn't, well, save that for later. War of Words has 2 copies. Declarations, Printing a New Nation, has 8. It runs at the Leventhal Map and Education Center at the Boston Public Library through September 13. It was curated by the BPL's Jay Moskela and the Center's Garrett Dash Nelson. Pressing importance, Salem and the Declaration of Independence has 7. It runs at the Peabody Essex Museum through July 25th of next year. Dan Lipkin, director of Pems Phillips Library, curated. But the Declaration is the verbal summit of the Revolution. The approaches to it are covered with many other examples of written material to be found in those shells, and 2 others, Charting Independence at the Harvard Map Collection through November 30th, curated by the collection's Mary Molly Taylor Pulaski, and Harvard and the American Revolution at Harvard's Pusey Library through December 18th, curated by Emily Atkins, Ariana Cook, Hannah Hack, Virginia Hunt, Juliana Coopers, and Sarah Martin. That's almost as many curators as the number of years reading Lexington and Concord and Yorktown. Those examples include broadsides, books, letters, diaries, newspapers, almanacs, prints, poems, sheet music, song lyrics, maps, a royal proclamation, giving equal time to the other side of the Atlantic. One of the books in War of Words includes a photograph taken in 1864 of a centenarian veteran. There are works from famous contemporaries, Thomas Jefferson, Thomas Paine, Alexander Hamilton, Samuel Johnson, who relish pointing out the hypocrisy of Americans who proclaim their allegiance to liberty yet own slaves. There are works from famous writers looking back on the Revolution. War of Words includes both a manuscript copy of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere and Frederick Douglass's Corinthian Hall Oration from 1852, also known as What to the American Slave is Your Fourth of July. Most interesting of all, perhaps, are anonymous documents, paper money, a continental enlistment form, a message to his war bond, a Stamp Act stamp, an invoice from Harvard for damages from Continental troops to 3 buildings during the Siege of Boston. The legislature reimbursed the university, but not until 1778. Tea and Liberty Trees, Midnight Rides and Muskets all played a revolutionary role. None of them, and not even muskets, mattered as much as words on paper did. This was the age of reason, and America was the land of literacy. The number of white males in the 13 colonies who could read in 1770 is estimated to have been between 85% and 90%. In Britain, it was 60%. Yes, words mattered there, too, but not as much as monarchy. All of the shows take note of the dominance of white males. Lest we forget, George III was a white male, too. The noting is invariably pertinent without being overly tendentious. Sometimes it's indirect, the point made through presenting exceptions. A 1777 copy of the Declaration in the BPL show was published by a female printer, Mary Catherine Goddard. Mapping independence includes Marie Madeleine Folville Gardette's map of the Plan de l'Attaque at Yorktown. Gardette's map is among the more than 2,000 vintage Revolutionary-era maps available online via Argo, American Geographics Online, at argomaps.org. The site is organized by the Leventhal Center and the George Washington Presidential Library at Mount Vernon. Participating local institutions include the Harvard Map Collection, Boston Athenaeum, Massachusetts Historical Society, and the NAFL Map Collection at Phillips Andover Academy. Go and expect to be engrossed. The site is a terrific example of public-spirited, scholarly collaboration. Terms like War of Words and Fighting Words scant the fact that the Revolution was an actual war with actual fighting. Our rote hagiography about the Revolution often ignores how brutal it was. Among the many virtues of the American Revolution, the 12-hour PBS documentary directed by Ken Burns, Sarah Botstein, and David Schmidt that aired last fall was it being so clear-eyed about that brutality. Amid all the documents on display at Harvard, the BPL, and the PEM, it's startling to see the sheer materiality of a button from a redcoat's uniform in War and Words, and in Harvard and the American Revolution, 5 musket balls. They look harmless, like marbles or jawbreakers, makes their intent no less deadly. Really, the Revolution was the first American Civil War. Instead of North versus South, it was Tory or Loyalist versus Patriot or Rebel. The term used indicated which side the user was on. How many of us, teleported back to 1776, would find ourselves more inclined to be Tories? Be honest now, never underestimate the lure of the status quo. A demonstration of how divided American society was back then comes from Ezekiel Russell, 1743 to 1796. A Salem printer, his place of business was close to where the PEM is now. He's a centerpiece of pressing importance. Russell printed 3 of the declarations in the show, including the official version printed by order of the Massachusetts state government. Yet prior to moving from Boston to Salem in 1774, Russell printed publications supporting British rule as well as opposing it. One was a defense of the Tea Act, the legislation that inspired the Boston Tea Party. Declarations of the BPL that has the official message's copy, too. It also has a particularly charming 19th-century copy of the Declaration, a reproduction with the clipped autographed signatures of all but one of the signers attached to the bottom. Another 19th-century version in the PEM show from 1819 includes facsimile signatures, portraits of several founders, and 13 allegorical engravings encircling the text, one for each of the colonies. The show concludes with Mindy Bailoff's 2010 unambiguous edition of the Declaration. It pays homage to Goddard's 1777 version by reproducing it with one key difference. The two references to men become people. You have to look closely to see the difference, but once you know it's there, you feel it. This isn't updating, it's improving. It's also a reminder that the best celebrations are about the present and future, as well as the past. Thank you for joining us for this edition of the Boston Globe. I'm Pamela.
And I'm Joan. Thank you for listening.